This is United Tribes News Radio. Insights into Native culture, people, ideas, topics to improve understanding from United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. Have you heard the one about the Frenchman who walked into a bar with a parrot on his shoulder? Well, stick with us, and you will, in this archive edition of United Tribes News Radio. The presenter is author Joseph Marshall III, a Sakandja Lakota from Rosebud. Marshall extended the hand of friendship to students at United Tribes Technical College to speak with insight from within the culture.
Good evening. I'm from Rosebud. I was born and raised there. Grew up there with a very traditional family, so I consider myself somewhat of a traditionalist. My first language is Lakota, my second language is English, and sometime before I get too old, I'm going to start working on my third ancestral language, which is French. I'll let you know in a couple years how that goes. As a traditional person, I have two traditional names. I think it might be interesting for you to know what those names are and where they came from. The first traditional name, I remember vaguely the ceremony in which it was given. I must have been 4 or 5 at the time, and you know how it is when you're 4 and 5, concrete memory doesn't really happen. But the name I was given was Ohitia Otai. In Lakota, that means roughly, in English, that means roughly, we have heard of his courage. I didn't earn the name, I just inherited it. It was given to me because the previous owner of the name was killed in World War II. He was an uncle. He was killed when he was only 19. And it's a name that goes way, way back in our family. I don't know how far back it goes, but it's an old, old name. So I'm very proud of it. I try not to dishonor it in any way, even though I didn't earn it. My second name that I gave to myself, which is, you know, some people do. I like it. It's appropriate. And I don't know if any of you understand Lakota, but in Lakota, my second name is Tahanku Shikshiche. And loosely translated, that means he who has ugly brothers-in-law. And if you were to see my brothers-in-law, you would know that it's a real good name. Given what's going on in the world, I thought for this evening I would touch a little bit on three things. And you can draw your own conclusions. I'm not a great philosopher. I can raise a lot of questions, but sometimes I have a hard time drawing conclusions. But maybe I'll raise some questions in your mind. I thought I'd touch a little bit with some readings on three things: truth, perspective, and reality. So the two readings I selected for this evening will touch on those three things. A Frenchman walks into a bar with a very, very large, very colorful parrot on his shoulder. And the bartender is intrigued. This is a sight that is very rare. One doesn't ever see a Frenchman with a parrot on his shoulder every day. And he's assuming there's got to be an interesting story here. So he calls out, "Hey, where did you get that thing?" To which the parrot replies, "In France, there are thousands of them." That's perspective. It comes from someplace you don't expect. And there are, as I mentioned, three things in our world, our existence, our interactions with one another as people, nations, and cultures that, as far as I'm concerned, are critically important, and those things are truth, perspective, and reality. These readings have something to do with that. I hope you don't mind being read too. It dawned on me that I didn't have to prepare any remarks for this evening's presentation because I've already written them. What a concept. This is a chapter, part of a chapter, I won't read the whole thing and bore you to tears, a part of a chapter from the Lakota Way. It's chapter 7, it's about truth. And in this chapter, the word Lakota word for truth is Wowichake. And it is that which is real, or the way the world is. And it opens with a story, an old, old story about Iktomi. You know, you've heard the trickster stories. I mean, the trickster stories, the character varies from culture to culture. But in some cases, he's a coyote. Sometimes he's something else. But he's always in trouble. He's always got a problem that he's got to solve in order to eat or have a place to sleep or whatever. It kind of reminds me of my brothers-in-law, actually. So there's never any physical description of Iktomi, but when I hear an Iktomi story, I always think of my brothers-in-law. Right off the bat, I have a good laugh. Iktomi's stomach was growling as he crawled out of the deserted bear's den where he had been sleeping. He woke up hungry, but that was nothing new to Iktomi. He liked to sleep more than anything, so he was hungry a lot. Still, he wasn't too worried. He always found a way to feed himself, though it wasn't because he was a good hunter. Iktomi was not a hunter at all. His only real skill was that he was tricky, one of the trickiest beings around. He preferred living off the work or the mistakes of others. At that, he was very good. That was the truth about Iktomi. He rubbed sleep from his eyes and looked around. It was a fine summer afternoon. The cottonwood tree's leaves were singing in a playful breeze while the grasses danced. Red-winged blackbirds added their bright call, and somewhere a meadowlark joined in. Not far away, in the shade of an oak grove, white-tailed deer dozed in the cool shade of a plum thicket. Iktomi didn't care about such things, unless they somehow meant he could be comfortable. He didn't see anything that meant he could eat, so he set out across the prairie to look for a quick meal. The chokecherries, plums, and buffalo berries were not yet ripe, and he hadn't forgotten his stomach ache from eating green berries, so he ignored them. There were fish, bullheads in the river, but that meant he would have to catch grasshoppers for bait. He wouldn't eat fish today because grasshoppers were much too fast and too hard to catch. He rested on the hilltop after a long climb. As he sat looking out over the rolling prairies, he thought he heard laughter on the wind. Sweaty and hungry, his mood was like a blustery black cloud, and laughter was the last thing he wanted to hear. Still, he was curious and listened closely. There it was, laughter, from many voices like the sound of an annoying mosquito. Curiosity pushed aside his annoyance. Anything unusual was always good to look into, since it could mean food. Iktomi listened and started walking in the direction of the laughter. The trouble was that the prairie was low, rolling hills in every direction, and the wind could play tricks. Sometimes the laughter seemed to come from behind him, sometimes from the left or right. After stumbling to the top of several hills, Iktomi noticed that the noise was louder, and with the laughter he heard splashing. He knew there was a small, shallow lake nearby and decided to look there. Iktomi grinned after he came to the top of yet another hill. Opportunity seemed to be favoring him this day. There was the lake, and on it was a large flock of ducks. They were laughing and having a good time. And they were so busy having fun they didn't see Iktomi. His stomach growled louder. He hid behind the soapweed and began thinking of a plan. Iktomi was always at his best when he was driven by hunger. So his thoughts flashed through his mind like lightning. With a self-satisfied smile, he sneaked down to a creek bottom and quickly gathered a large bundle of sticks. Tying them together snugly, he hoisted the bundle onto his back and set out for the lake and the ducks. From the top of the hill, he walked purposefully down, the bundle of wood on his back, and he bent beneath it as if it were a heavy load. He kept his eyes straight ahead and never once looked in the direction of the singing and dancing ducks. As he knew what happened, one of the ducks spotted Iktomi and shouted a warning, "Look out! It's Iktomi." He was well known to the ducks, but he would eat anything. Some of the ducks took to wing and a hush fell over the lake. Strangely, Iktomi took no notice of the anxious ducks. He continued on, bent under his load of wood, seemingly in a hurry. The ducks who fled returned to the lake. They all watched the strange sight of Iktomi bent under a bundle of wood, marching purposefully onward and ignoring them. No one, no matter who, likes to be ignored. And Iktomi was ignoring the ducks, not for a moment acknowledging they were even in the same world. He kept walking, his stomach kept growling. Soon he was past them and walking away from the lake. It was more than the ducks could stand. "Iktomi," one of them called out. Iktomi kept walking. "Iktomi," they called out with one voice. Iktomi paused, his eyes blinking vaguely as he glanced about. He slowly turned and toward the lake and saw the ducks. Surprise registered on his face. "How?" he called out. "My friends, are you well? What are you doing?" "We are dancing, celebrating," they told him. "It's such a good day." "I'm happy for you," Iktomi called back. Then looking off, he turned to leave. The ducks didn't know what to do or how to act. Iktomi was not acting like Iktomi. It was too much for them. They had to know why. "Wait," they called. "What are you doing? Why are you carrying all that wood?" Iktomi wiped his brow and seemed anxious to go. "This is not wood, you see," he said to them. "These are songs. For sure, they are sacred songs. I'm taking them to a celebration over there by the river." He shifted his load and started walking. "They're waiting for me. I have to get there before sunset." The ducks raised a commotion, all of them shouting, "Wait, wait, don't go yet, sing. Sing us one of the songs so we can dance." Ikutomi hesitated, thinking deeply for a moment. "No, I can't," he replied. "I have a long way to go, and they're waiting. Besides, these are sacred songs, and I don't think I should sing one to you people. I don't know you." "Don't go," they shouted. "We want to hear one of those songs." Ikutomi sighed and stopped, waving his hands impatiently. "I do need to rest," he said, sitting down in the grass as his stomach rumbled again. "I've been walking since sunrise. After I catch my breath, perhaps I can sing you one song. But I don't know. These are sacred songs, and I don't know if you should hear them." The ducks raised a clamor. "No, no, we want to hear just a song, just one." They all swam to the shore and waddled onto the grass and surrounded Ikutomi, their beady little eyes pleading with him. It was very hard for Ikutomi not to reach out and snatch one of them, because they were all fat, and he knew the meat would be tender and juicy roasted over the fire. His stomach growled, and he laughed to cover the noise as he sighed and wiped his brow. "Yes, yes," he muttered, "I'll sing you one song. Then I must be on my way." Quacking joyously, the ducks clambered back into the water, laughing in anticipation. It wasn't often they could dance to a sacred song. Ikutomi nearly drooled as he watched them, but he knew he had to play out the ruse or he would go hungry again. After a moment, he carefully untied his bundle and laid out the sticks and studied each one. He would pick up a stick, mumble and hum, shake his head, then put it down and pick up another. The ducks, of course, were curious. "What are you doing?" they asked. "I'm looking for the right song for you. I must find the one that will be good for you," he exclaimed wisely. "Yes," said the ducks, "pick out the right one. We'll wait." Ikutomi dutifully picked up one stick after another, mumbling and humming until he found the one he wanted. It was a sturdy stick, of course, and it was just right for what he had in mind. For the ducks, it was the right song. "This is the one," he announced. The ducks cheered. Their quacking was loud and annoying, but Ikutomi smiled. "Now," he said, "since this is a sacred song, there is something you must do when I start singing." "Tell us," the ducks yelled. "Tell us what to do." "When I begin to sing, you must close your eyes tightly. This is a sacred song, and it has powers. I don't know what will happen if you open your eyes. I will close my eyes, too, because I know how powerful these songs are. They are so powerful that I was told never to sing them with my eyes open, and others who hear them must also close their eyes. Do you understand?" "Yes, yes, we understand," they clamored. Ikutomi found a soft, grassy spot and sat holding the stick. He cleared his throat. "I must warn you," he said. "If you open your eyes while I'm singing, your eyes will turn red and stay that way. So no matter what happens, no matter what you hear, keep your eyes closed. This is a sacred song, and who knows what powers will come when I sing. We will keep our eyes closed," they promised. Ikutomi cleared his throat, closed his eyes, and bowed his head for a long moment. Then he began to sing. His voice rose and fell rhythmically, for if nothing else, Ikutomi was a good singer. Perhaps that went along with being tricky. The ducks were impressed with Ikutomi's fine singing voice. They closed their eyes and swam out and began to dance. Ikutomi poured his heart into the song, and because of his stomach, of course, it was empty and growling. The ducks splashed and swayed to the song, their eyes tightly shut. Ikutomi opened one eye slightly. The water was white with the splashing of the ducks. His mouth watered at the sight of so much food, but he kept singing louder and louder. When he was certain the ducks were totally engrossed in the dance, Ikutomi rose to his feet and walked along the shore, first one way and then the other. He began to dance too, so that if one of the ducks happened to open his eyes, he would see that Ikutomi was dancing with him, but no one did. After several passes back and forth along the shore so that his voice came from several directions, Ikutomi waded carefully into the water. Slowly, slowly he worked his way toward the ducks as it continued to dance and splash. Then Ikutomi hefted his stick, testing its balance, as he took a few practice swings, singing all the time, of course. Finally, he was in among the ducks as their fat, succulent bodies bobbed on the water in time to Ikutomi's song. He danced, making loud, splashing noises himself. The ducks kept on dancing, unaware of the slobbering, hungry grin on Ikutomi's face. With a swift, skillful swing, Ikutomi bashed one of the ducks, but there was so much splashing the others took no notice. Encouraged, he swung again. And a little while later, he swung the club again and again. Soon, seven ducks were floating dead in the water, while the others continued splashing and dancing. Ikutomi could already imagine the ducks roasting over a fire, and his hunger rose like a hot wind. Throwing caution aside, Ikutomi flailed away, still singing. Several more ducks fell victim to his club until there was not as much splashing. A duck opened his eyes and saw Iktomi among them and several of his fellow birds floating lifeless on the water. "Look out," the duck cried. Fly away, or Iktomi will kill us all." Other ducks opened their eyes to see the carnage, and in a whirr of wings they fled from the hungry Iktomi. But for many of them, it was too late. Iktomi's song turned into a gleeful laugh as he began to gather his booty. The remaining ducks were long over the horizon, out of his reach. But to a duck, their eyes had turned red because they opened their eyes during Iktomi's song. To this day, their descendants have red eyes also. They can be seen now and then flying above, floating on a pond, cautiously throwing red-eyed glances right and left, always on the lookout for Iktomi. Iktomi feasted until he could eat no more, roasting ducks over the flames from the bundle of wood he had gathered as his sacred songs. Then he found a place to sleep. So, if Iktomi comes and says he has songs for you, don't close your eyes when he sings. The trouble is, who knows what form Iktomi might take when he comes to you? That's one of my favorite stories I learned as a 5, 6, 7-year-old kid. And I didn't figure out until later on, maybe when I was in college, that it was a story about truth. That's what this chapter is about, truth. An Easterner moved to the West to live the slow-paced elemental lifestyle he had always yearned after. In the autumn, he purchased a rustic log house at the base of a mountain. Since his only source of heat was a wood stove, he set about laying in wood. Soon, he had a very large pile next to his house. But since his only preparation for winter had previously been to turn up the thermostat in his apartment, he didn't know if he had put up enough wood to keep him warm through the winter. So he decided to ask a few people. "Go to the top of the mountain," a neighbor asked. "Up there lives a wise old Indian. He can give you the advice you need." So the Easterner climbed the mountain, which was no simple task for someone used to stairs and escalators, and found an old Indian man sitting in front of a tiny log cabin. "I was wondering," he said, getting immediately to the point. "I have a wood stove to heat my house. How will I know how much wood is enough to last the winter through?" The old Indian stood, walked to the edge of the mountain, looked up into the sky, into the surrounding forest, and down the mountain, and returned to his seat. "More wood," he said. The Easterner climbed back down, went to work. In a week or so, he had a pile of wood half the size of his house. He felt better. But soon the doubts began to creep in, so he decided to visit the old Indian once again. The climb to the top of the mountain was no easier the second time, but the old Indian was still there. "I put up more wood, but I'm still not sure I have enough," he confessed. Whereupon the old Indian stood, walked to the edge of the mountain, looked up into the sky, into the surrounding forest, and down the mountain, and returned to his chair. "More wood," he uttered. The Easterner climbed back down and went back to work. In 2 weeks, he doubled his wood pile and was feeling more secure, certain now that he could stay warm through the entire winter. But he was curious about how that old Indian on the mountain knew how much wood was enough. So he decided to ask him. After yet another long, arduous climb, the Easterner found the old Indian sitting in front of his log cabin. "Sir," he said, "I have more than enough wood to last me through the winter. I thank you for your advice. But I must know the basis of your wisdom. I noticed you looked up into the sky and into the forest. Is that how you knew how much wood I would need to get me through the winter?" "Not really," replied the old Indian. "Below me lives a white man, and he's been laying in wood like you wouldn't believe. That's how I know." Sometimes truth comes from the strangest places. I asked my grandfather once, when he was in his 60s, I believe, if he could tell me what truth was. "I don't think I've lived long enough to know that," he said. "All I know is that without it, Iktomi would be the most powerful being on earth, and that's the truth. Having lived more than half a century myself, I think I'm just beginning to gain some insight into my grandfather's reply. Truth is often difficult to distinguish. It can be a gift or a burden. It can be kind or cruel. It frequently eludes our grasp, and we find it difficult to describe. In the end, we learn we can't live without it. Truth is the marker along the roads we travel in life," my grandfather did say. "The red road has many markers. If you choose the black road, there is only the illusion of truth. We can be influenced by truth or by illusion." Two chieftains met on a plain while their two armies waited. "I have 10,000 warriors, everyone skilled with weapons and seasoned by battle. Victory will be mine," said the first chieftain. "What do you have?" "Only the truth," replied the second chieftain. "This war has decimated my people, so I face you now with an army of 1,000 children. This truth will either destroy you or glorify you." The first chieftain returned to his camp, where his army of 10,000 stood ready for battle. He ordered his army to put aside their weapons while he went into seclusion to ponder the truth his enemy had spoken. With the new dawn, he sent his chief aide with gifts of food and an offer of peace to the army of 1,000 children. The first chieftain then returned to his homeland and stood to be judged before his countrymen, fully expecting to be dishonored for his weakness. He was instead made a king. Sometimes truth is like the wind. You can't see it, but you can see the effect it has. In the Lakota world, reality is, for example, that the four seasons cycle in precisely the same order year after year. Reality is that lakes and rivers freeze in winter and thaw in the spring, that all living things die. That change is inevitable. Some rise out of the illusions we have acquired. For example, good will always prevail over evil. Truth is subjective, as in the story of the blind man and the elephant. It is also subject to change, as in man was not intended to fly. If there is a universal human weakness, it is that we want to believe there is truth because we want clear answers rather than illusions, and therefore we are vulnerable to anything that seems to be. Truth consists of two parts, that which is given and that which is accepted. In the story of the Trichter song, the Iktomi story, Iktomi and the ducks created a truth. Iktomi wanted the ducks to believe because he was hungry, while the ducks wanted to believe because they wanted to dance. The truth lasted only until one duck opened his eyes and realized yet another truth. Iktomi was killing them, and they would all die if they didn't flee. If the ducks had remained skeptical, the momentary truth would not have come about. All the ducks would have lived, and Iktomi would have walked away hungry. We Lakota have heard Iktomi sing several times. At the Fort Laramie Treaty Council of 1851, as thousands upon thousands of white immigrants made their way along the Oregon Trail from Missouri to Oregon and passed through Lakota territory, the United States Peace Commissioners told us they are only passing through and need only as much room as the width of their wagon wheels. And I'm sure our ancestors said at the time what was equivalent of, yeah, right. At least I imagine they did. The Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 established the Great Sioux Reservation, the entire western half of the current state of South Dakota. For as long as the grass shall, as long as the sun shall rise, as long as the rivers shall flow, as long as the grasses shall grow. The truth is sometimes painful. Without it, there is only illusion. The truth is we Lakota still walk the face of the earth. The truth is we survived traumatic change and are wiser and stronger because of it. The illusion is that we were defeated by a stronger, better, more moral people with more God-given rights than we had. The truth is we were overwhelmed by numbers, more people with more guns needing more and more of what we had. The illusion is that we are a conquered people. The truth is that we are survivors. We took on the worst that our conquerors could throw at us, and we're still standing. The illusion is that we are part of the past, something to be studied, analyzed, measured, dissected, and ultimately judged. The truth is, we are still a viable culture with traditions, customs, and values that have stood the severest tests. There are many certainties and even more illusions masquerading as truth. Nothing short of living and learning will enable us to know the difference. The first chieftain accepted the truth he heard and reacted to it with the truth of his own character and was rewarded. The Easterner benefited from the wisdom of a man who sought truth in others. Iktomi, on the other hand, presented illusion as truth and always will. Truth is what we make it. It serves our own ends. The Lakota regarded the Western migration of the white man as invasion. The white man regarded it as an entitlement. The Lakota look at the land and see a relative. The white man looks at the land and sees a commodity. Neither side is wrong, because ultimately, all we can do is live our own truth. Sometimes, however, one truth finds another. In other words, beware of Iktomi. This is a book that I wrote, I can't remember when, 1994, I believe. And it's called On Behalf of the Wolf of the First Peoples. And some of the issues it addresses is sort of similar to what I just finished reading. It's a collection of essays. This one is titled, strangely, Not All Indians Dance. Among non-Indians, there continues to exist many misconceptions about Indians. Such misconceptions, I believe, are the remnants of pre-20th century European and Euro-American descriptions of and attitudes about Indians. Characterizations of Indians in 17th, 18th, and 19th century non-Indian America were somewhat polarized. On the one hand, Indians were considered the children of nature, and on the other hand, they were seen as the vilest miscreants of the savage race. As children of nature, noble red man was another label. We were accorded mystical and mysterious qualities because of our perceived or assumed abilities to commune with nature and to otherwise exist in an environment confusing and mysterious to Europeans. As miscreants and savages, we were feared and detested. We infested the land and along with bears and wolves in an environment feared and misunderstood by the newcomers. Both descriptions stem from misinformation, ignorance, and myth, and often given impetus by various writers of the day, such as James Fenimore Cooper and Francis Parkman. But somewhere in between the polarized characterizations of Indians and Indian culture, steadfastly resisting the populist literary jibes of the Coopers and the Parkmans and their current versions, is the reality that we were and are. This is a reality that non-Indians still have difficulty discovering, and it is this difficulty, I believe, that prevents other Americans from perceiving us and interacting with us as we are, human beings no better or no worse than any other group of human beings. All misguided and ill-founded opinions about Indians do us damage. However, the one that is often overlooked or even accepted because it seems to be less offensive, though ultimately is just as misleading and just as damaging, is a notion that Indians are or should be mystical and mysterious. When this assumption is connected to the notion that Indians are capable of communing with nature, sensible Indian approaches to relating to the natural environment are obscured. Although we did and do commune with nature, that communion is not based on mystical abilities, but on our acceptance of the realities of the physical world. In short, we accepted the facts of what nature is and does. Our grasp of the fundamental realities of our environment, such as never setting up an encampment in a known and active floodplain, is obscured when anyone regards them as mystical or mysterious. Several years ago, I was interviewed on camera for a cable television program about the West. The segment was about Crazy Horse. He was one of the best known Indian leaders to emerge from the turbulent years in the Northern Plains in the latter half of the last century. The segment producer had done his homework in preparation for the interview. His questions about Crazy Horse were appropriate, insightful, and calculated to elicit responses that would tell a cohesive chronological story. At the conclusion of the interview, he asked if there was anything I would like to add. So my reply was, well, we could talk about how he was a dead shot with a bow. The young producer smiled politely and dismissed my comment with an offhanded remark, thereby ending the interview. He was more interested in the mystical aspects of Crazy Horse and his life and times, the legend rather than the man. He could not be persuaded to talk about something so mundane as a Lakota warrior shooting a bow. But in refusing to do so, he totally disregarded a very human aspect of Crazy Horse. There seem to be two approaches in all writings about Crazy Horse. One approach tends to establish and enhance the legend, and the other tends to diminish and distort his image and accomplishments. Neither approach is overly concerned about that the legend was first a human being, a man. However, if we want to know and understand Crazy Horse as a man, we must brush aside the veil of mystery and mysticism because they stand between us and reality. I wanted that young producer to know more about Crazy Horse. I wanted to describe the ordinary things that Crazy Horse did, things that helped define his identity and that are part of life for every Lakota man, woman, and child. I wanted to stress aspects of real life that contributed to Crazy Horse's humanity, such as his grief over the death of his younger brother, or his sense of guilt because a close friend and mentor was killed in battle before an intense disagreement between them had been reconciled. And nothing was more real or humanly mundane than Crazy Horse's lapse in judgment when he tried to steal another man's wife. The lapse in judgment that nearly cost him his life and did cost him a position of leadership. If all of these events are not considered relevant to Crazy Horse's identity, then it's certainly because we are blinded by the legend of Crazy Horse. We see legends riding ahead of hundreds of warriors to lead an attack. We see legends riding up into the clouds on white horses. We see mysticism and mystery, but we miss seeing the man. If we did see inside the man, inside the legend, we would see that Crazy Horse was human enough to weep at the death of a brother and friend, human enough to allow his love and lust for woman to destroy his judgment. We would see that the man inside the legend could shoot a bow with deadly accuracy, make a bow and arrows, tie his moccasin laces, pull his leggings on one leg at a time, feel the winter's cold, perhaps dread getting up in the morning, fall asleep on the back of a horse from bone weary exhaustion, feel more than a little tinge of jealousy knowing that the woman he loved belonged to another man, or feel his stomach ball up in knots just before a battle. All of this is what I wanted to tell the young producer about Crazy Horse. Sadly, the producer seemed to have been seduced by the legend. Didn't I want to look behind what he perceived to be more appropriate and important, the aura of mysticism and mystery. An incident happened to me a few years ago that seemed to point out this while I was still living on the Rosebud Reservation. On this occasion, I went to watch the traditional dancing at the annual Rosebud Fair. I was attending the evening session, and as I walked to the bleachers under the arbor to find a good perch from which to watch dancing, I found myself suddenly surrounded by a non-Indian family, and they had a few questions. Their questions were courteous, not unusual for people who were seeing Indians dancing up close and personal for the first time. I answered them the best I could. And as courteously as they had been asked, it was my answer to their final question which provoked a most unusual reaction. "When will you dance?" the man asked. "Well, I don't dance," I replied. There was profound shock on their faces. Apparently, I had given the wrong answer. "You don't dance?" the woman asked. It was more of a plea for me to change my answer. "No," I said, "I don't dance." "Do you sing?" said one of the children. "No," I replied, "I don't sing either." "Why?" asked another one of the children. "Well," I said, "not all Indian dance and not all Indians sing." They backed away from me and disappeared into the crowd, taking their shock and their disappointment with them. The reaction and the attitude that facilitated is not unusual among non-Indians even today. For far too long, non-Indians, generally speaking, have approached us only so far. They will go to a powwow, or buy a pair of moccasins, or read a history book on Indian religion. They may tell themselves that they are really getting into Indian culture or history. In truth, they are more like the person who comes to a lake for a swim, but only ends up walking around and around, cautiously testing the water by sticking a toe or a foot in. In the end, the person does not swim because he is afraid that the water may be too cold or too deep. Going to a powwow or buying a pair of moccasins brings you to the edge of the lake, so to speak. Reading books about Indian history and religion is like sticking a toe or a foot into the water. If you do not go into the water, you'll never learn that there are living, breathing human beings beneath the feathers and inside the beaded buckskin dresses at the powwow. Living, breathing human beings with a history, such as the following. One of the oldest man-made artifacts in North America is an approximately 27,000-year-old tool, a height scraper, found near Old Crow Flats in the Yukon Territory. The Arabi Pueblo has been continuously inhabited for at least 1,000 years, making it the oldest town in North America. So eat your heart out, St. Augustine, Florida. In 1869, Eli Parker, a Seneca Indian, was the first Indian to be appointed United States Indian Commissioner. Prior to that, he was a Brigadier General in the United States Army and was with General Grant at Appomattox when General Lee surrendered. The Iroquois Confederacy was a representative and deliberative body composed of six nations within which women had a very strong voice. Some scholars argue that it was a direct influence on the shaping of the United States Constitution. Many current highways in the United States are ancient trails first used by Indians and of course later blazed by European and Euro-American explorers. All of the current surviving Indian nations in the United States are older than the United States. Charles Curtis, Vice President under Herbert Hoover, was a Kaw Indian from Oklahoma. This was in the 1930s. He was also the first Indian to serve in the United States Senate. The downside of this story is that he didn't want people to know he was Indian. The Bureau of Indian Affairs was established in 1824. within the Department of War. The Indian Health Service was established in 1955 and is not part of the Department of Human and Health Services. Indians were made citizens of the United States by an act of Congress in 1924. They didn't ask us if we wanted to be citizens, by the way. They just said, you're citizens. Interesting enough, my grandfather, Charles Marshall, was in World War I. He was a soldier in the Army in 1918. And he went back to France, the land of his father, and fought there. And he said that he liked to say that he fought as a mercenary for the United States because he was not then a citizen of the United States. So technically, he was right. Speaking of that, about 8,000 Indians served in the United States Armed Forces in World War I, 25,000 in World War II, 12,000 in the Korean War, 45,000 in the Vietnam War, and one of the first American servicemen to die in Desert Storm was a Sioux Indian Marine from South Dakota. And of course you know about Private Loy Paestua from Arizona, first Native American woman to die, first woman to die in combat in the uniform of the United States. 18 United States Congressional Medals of Honor were awarded to soldiers of the United States 7th and 9th Cavalries for their action at Wounded Knee in 1890. 7th Cavalry was, of course, the unit that was defeated at the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876, 14 years early. And many of the same company commanders who survived that battle were still in the Army and still serving with the 7th Cavalry when they surrounded Chief Bigfoot's band at Wounded Knee Creek. And of course, the 9th Cavalry are the famed Buffalo Soldiers. The Indian Reorganization Act of 1934 gave Indian tribes the right to self-government. I thought we had it before, but who knows? The concept of reservations for Indians was born before the United States was born. There are over 380 federal and 23 state reservations in the United States. Virtually no reservation is a solid block of Indian-owned or controlled land. Most reservations have to contend with substantial white land ownership within their borders, which in turn is the basis for continuing questions and problems regarding civil and criminal jurisdiction. It's a fact of life for us. 26 of the 50 state names are taken from Indian names or words, including Texas and Indiana loosely into that category raises the number to 28. 31 of the 50 states have at least one Indian reservation, with California having 75. There are no reservations in Oklahoma or Alaska. Surprise, surprise. Actually, it's just a game of semantics. The land there is called Indian Trust Lands, or Federal Trust Lands. Two of the bigger issues facing Indians today are gambling on the reservations and the location of nuclear waste storage facilities on reservations. If you're in touch with the politics with your home reservations, don't be surprised if you hear rumors about waste storage companies putting a lot of pressure on tribal councils. And they're dangling money from tribal councils to locate and build nuclear waste storage facilities on reservations. A few reservations have, but not all. There are now at least 35 Indian-founded and controlled colleges on several reservations across this country, which is a great fact. And at least 27 non-Indian institutions of higher learning other than Indian colleges offer at least a major in Indian studies. Of course, the list goes on and on, based on interesting as well as the tragic aspects of Indian history, rich and varied cultures and lifestyles, and the current issues and problems that face Indians day in and day out. Such information can be a source of insight and enlightenment into cultures that are old beyond remembering and people who have existed for millennia. Therefore, you can understand why it is so important for you to come into the water, as it were. If you don't, you may never see beyond the narrow viewpoints of the history books which tend to ignore or slant Indian history. Then the chances are that you will allow yourself to believe that we're more important as part of the past and keep us there in your mind, thereby denying and or avoiding the fact that we're part of the present. If you don't come into the water, it will be easy and safe for you to lay that mantle of mystery and mysticism on us. Then you can always keep us at arm's length. You will stick your toe in the water now and then, but you will never jump in. And in the end, we will all lose. Because we will never be anything more to you than objects of mystery and sources of mysticism. You may well buy many pairs of Indian moccasins in your time, but you will never know how it feels to walk in them. Shrugging off the mantle of mystery and mysticism is not an easy thing for us to do. Sometimes we are not allowed to do this or even try. Like the tourist family that refused to believe that I don't dance. Many non-Indians are loath to give up their myths when it comes to Indians. A further complication is that there is no single answer or solution. One size doesn't fit all. At the same time, we must not allow the complexity of the situation to obscure the fact that we're facing a basic human problem, a failure to communicate. There is an anecdote that makes its rounds now and then, and I think it's appropriate to this discussion. A cowboy was looking to buy a horse, and he was told that a certain old Indian had several good horses for sale. The cowboy went to the Indian's place and was led into a corral full of horses. As he moved around the milling animals, he noticed one standing in a corner alone. It was a tall, good-looking sorrel, straight legs. After sizing the sorrel up for several minutes, the cowboy announced that he wanted to buy him. The old Indian protested. "He doesn't look so good," he replied. The cowboy became impatient over such an obvious sales tactic. "You couldn't be more wrong, chief," he said. "It's the best-looking horse you have." The old Indian said once more, "He doesn't look so good." The cowboy's insistence won out, however. He bought the sorrel, paid for him, saddled him, and rode away. Just after sunset, he returned to the Indian's corral, leading the sorrel. Horse and cowboy were limping. The man's clothes were torn, and he had an assortment of bumps and bruises. And he was angry. "Chief," the cowboy said, "this damn horse ran off the edge of a cliff with me. Why didn't you tell me he was blind?" The old Indian shook his head and said, "I did. I told you he doesn't look so good." Communication is a two-way process. The failure to communicate is due to many reasons. Silence is the biggest factor, but in my opinion, it is slightly ahead of selective hearing. Selective hearing is obviously hearing only what one wants to hear. We encounter that problem among some historians who are fearful of what they label revisionist history. They are fearful that revisionist historians are out to change history, but what they are really afraid of is what they may be forced to hear. They may be forced to hear what they don't want to hear, both sides of the story, or all the facts. For example, when the agreement of 1875 is discussed, wherein Sioux leaders apparently yielded control of the Black Hills after the 1874 confirmation of the discovery of gold, it is referred to as a negotiated agreement. Historians fail to mention that the Sioux leaders were literally forced to agree due to the real threat of the immediate loss of annuities, of food and clothing and blankets and so forth, and by immediate forced removal of the Sioux people to Indian territory in Oklahoma. And there's another side to that story. During the negotiations, the peace commissioners marched in a squad of soldiers because the Indian leaders were sitting on the ground. Arranged that squad of soldiers in a semicircle behind the Indians, had the soldiers cock their rifles and aim them at the head of the Indians. And what are you going to do under that condition, that situation? You're going to sign the paper. There's another interesting aspect. In the 1980s, for those of you who keep track of the Battle of the Little Bighorn and the Little Bighorn National Monument, there were two grass fires, 81, 82, or 82, 83, somewhere in there, two summers apart. And the grass fires uncovered a whole pattern of metal artifacts. And so some archaeologists went in there with their metal detectors and cataloged the location of each one of those artifacts. There were belt buckles, but mostly there were shell casings and spent bullets. And that gave them an insight into where the soldiers moved and how they were being chased and so forth. Interesting enough, the pattern of artifact distribution in the long run held up the Indian versions of the battle and debunked the military versions of the battle. And I think there's two articles in the way back in 83 or 84 in National Geographic magazine, so if you're curious, look it up. A And sometimes historians simply fail to mention Indian involvement or contribution, such as the hundreds, if not thousands, of Indians who fought in the Civil War on both sides. The tourist family at the Rosebud Fair several years ago was not so much interested in whether or not I danced. Rather, they were looking for an affirmation of a myth that all Indians dance. They were not interacting with me as a person. They were trying to touch a myth. They didn't want to hear that I do not put on feathers and dance. They did not want to face the reality as related to one Indian. It seemed to be easier for them to safely categorize all Indians. If they had allowed communication to occur on a person-to-person basis, they might have learned that there is more to being Indian than dancing. I might have told them that while I do not dance, I do speak my native language. In point of fact, it is my primary language. I might have told them that I make bows and arrows, or that there are ancestral names like White Feather Tail, Uses Cane, Two Hawk, Good Voice Eagle, Blunt Arrow, Little Bird, Caught the Eagle, and even Morrison, Rubidoux, and McLean in my family tree. If communication had occurred, we would have met on common ground. I would have been able to shrug off the mantle of mystery and mysticism, and they would have been able to see past the myth. We would have met on the common ground of our humanity. Personally, I don't enjoy being a myth, and I suspect that a crazy horse could speak to us now, he would implore us to remember him as a man and not as a legend. In other words, see me as I am, as a person, a human being. If you must judge me at that level. Do not judge me on the basis of an image or an idea that has long ago lost its connection to reality. There is a general premise among many non-Indians that Indians are or should be mystical and mysterious. But that imposed aura of mysticism and mystery must be removed to find the real people, real values, real traditions, and sometimes ordinary, sometimes fascinating, but always very human and very real people. Given a choice, I'd much rather be mundane and ordinary than a vile miscreant. Several years ago, my oldest son worked at the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument, as I mentioned, as an interpretive ranger. And he gave presentations about the battle or various aspects of it from both sides. And one day he said, as he was about to give a presentation, a 10-year-old little white girl came up and said, "Sir, what is history?" And Mike said, "I was really trying to say something intelligent and something that a 10-year-old would understand." And before he could answer, she pulled on his sleeve again and she said, "I know what history is." And he said, "Okay, what's history?" And she smiled and said, "History is a lie that we all agree to tell." So hopefully something in the readings has shed some light on what perspective should be relative to history. And who knows how we will look at what's going on in Iraq 10 years from now. I wonder sometimes how much of what we hear is truth and how much is some publicist spin. But I guess we'll judge that in 10, 20, or 30 years.
That was author Joseph Marshall III speaking at United Tribes Technical College in 2003. At the time, his current book was The Lakota Way, Stories and Lessons for Living. Since then, he has continued to write other nonfiction books and novels, including The Long Knives Are Crying, The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn, To You We Shall Return, Lessons About Our Planet from the Lakota, and The Lakota Way of Strength and Courage. His work, The Archer, is an online novel. You can learn more about historian, author, and educator Joseph Marshall III at his website, thunderdreamers.com. This program was produced by United Tribes Technical College, Office of Public Information. Dennis Newman, director. Alicia Heglin-Thorpe, producer. This series is designed not only to strengthen our communities, but to give insight and understanding of a tribal culture and a Native people. For more information, visit our website, uttc.edu.